Snadvanu Savanam Tasmin Kalindya Shalile Shive Kridvochitani Nivasan Atmana Kalpitasana Snatva. After taking bath, Anusavanam, three times, Tasmin, in that, Kalindya, in the river Kalindi, Dayumuna, Shalile, in the water, Shive, which is very auspicious, Kritva, performing, Uchitani, suitable, Nivasan, sitting, Atmanaha, of the self, Kalpita Asana, having prepared a sitting place. Translation. Nard Muni instructed, my dear boy, in the waters of the Yamuna River, which is known as Kalindi, you should take three baths daily because the water is very auspicious, sacred and clear. Thank you. After bathing, you should perform the necessary regulative principles for Astanga Yoga, and then sit down on your asan, sitting place, in a calm and quiet position. Purport. It appears from this statement that Dhruva Maharaj had already been instructed how to practice the Eightfold Yoga System, which is known as Astanga Yoga. This system is explained in our Bhagavad Gita, as it is in the chapter entitled Shankhya Yoga, pages 319 to 322. It is understood that in Astanga Yoga one practices settling the mind and then concentrating it on the form of Lord Vishnu, as will be described in the following verses. It is clearly stated here that Astanga Yoga is not a bodily gymnastic exercise, but a practice to concentrate the mind on the form of Vishnu. Before sitting on his asan, which is also described in Bhagavad Gita, one has to cleanse himself very nicely in clear or sacred water thrice daily. The water of the Yamuna is naturally very clear and pure, and thus if anyone bathes there three times, undoubtedly he will be very greatly purified externally. Nard Muni therefore instructed Dhruva Maharaj to go to the bank of the Yamuna and thus become externally purified. This is part of the gradual process of practicing mystic yoga. So the Nard Muni is describing the process of yoga here, how to connect with the Lord. So in this age, then, the Astanga Yoga system would be used. So we see is the element of purity, the element of regulation, regulative principles of the particular process, then the actually being involved in the process, what's the actually main element. So that remains, no matter what age, it's just what the particular process is, that may change. Other things won't change. So, and the most essential thing why it will be named as yoga is because of its connection with the Lord. If it's not connected to the Lord, it won't be actually called yoga. We call Patanjali yoga because the yoga system is based on meditation upon the Lord. If you're meditating on nothing, not on the Lord, that's called Buddhism, right? Right? They have their wall or whatever it is that they put up, right? It's always funny, they have to have a wall, right? You know, it's like that, you know, this is something. Why can't it just be nothing? You know, but it's never just nothing. It's something to understand nothing, right? So, you know, so in here we see is that Dhruva Maharaj is, it says, Prabhupada's mentioning that he was previously, must have been instructed, because Nard Muni's not giving any direction. He just says, you follow that. So it must have been very standard knowledge in those days that everybody knew the process of self-realization. That was how much they were going to take advantage of it or not. But here it is. So he's 5 years old. He already understood this. And so then Narad Muni is simply giving that direction on how to connect this to the Supreme. This is the important point. The mechanics are the secondary aspect. You know, they take a lot of time. There's a lot of study, a lot of practice. But actually, the connection to the Lord, that's the most essential point. If that's missed, everything's been missed. If you catch that, even if you don't know all the techniques perfectly, still it works. Because it's the Lord that makes everything function. Means when we give the example that when you water the root of a tree, the whole tree becomes satisfied. So we have to understand is that this whole tree is Krishna's manifestation. Right? He is the cause of the whole cosmic creation. So if he's pleased, the creation becomes pleased. Right? So if you are in connection with the Lord, then you can appreciate his being pleased. Otherwise, if not, you will be unaware. Right? So the whole universe is going on. It develops. It does whatever it does. It has its results that it gains, the experiences. And that's all because of the Lord. Nothing else. No one else. So being the complete whole, that means everything. At the same time, as an individual person, then there's that direct interaction to please him. So whatever process is there, anything, it's all working because of it being part of Krishna's creation, part of God's creation. Otherwise, how would it work? How would it function? Illusion is that we think it's something separate from God. It's not. That's the illusion. Illusion's not something else. Illusion is simply whatever it is that you're dealing with, you think it's separate from Krishna. That's the illusion. Because it's all him, his potency. And him and his potency are non-different. Therefore, it's all him. So, Narad Muni then is pointing this out. You have this understanding, then you have everything. Because so many skills and so many ways you can learn. Now, if you specifically are just interested in self-realization, why bother using other more distracting elements to understand yourself? Right? Since the soul is eternal, soul is eternal servant of God, soul has nothing really to do with this material energy. So why involve yourself in a process that's very complex and has a lot of interaction with the material energy? If your only focus is actually just understanding yourself and understanding God. Therefore, there's these very direct methods. Right? Though still have the same complication. Your yoga system, still, they're taking bath very clean. They perform all their asanas and everything else to get themselves to the point of being able to meditate. So it does have that aspect of activity or karma. Treta Yuga, your yajñas, and what it takes to get all the facility for the yajñas, we see it's more complex. The Dwapara then is the deity worship. It's also quite direct, but instead of it simply being you perform activities, then meditate, it's done in such a way that you can meditate while you're active, but it's still directly on the Lord, right? Then you have yajna, which will be lower than that. But, you know, we always think of it that the I say, in the Dwapara, then Yajna is the main. That's only when Krishna comes. Swayam Krishna comes. All other times, the deity worship is in the second age, and the Yajna is in the third. So we see it becomes more and more complex. But then Kali Yuga, you would expect to become more complex again. But the point is people are so complex that they can't find God. So this process is clear away everything and leave only the essential point of the other three, which is chanting the holy name. It means we will see that Dhruva Maharaj is going to chant Om Namo Narayanaya. That's going to be the main element of his meditation. Right? Deity worship, you're always chanting the Lord's name. Yajna, you're always chanting the Lord's name. So the essential point is the name. So that will remain in the Kali Yuga. So sticking to that, that's the quickest, easiest, simplest. But because people have needs, right? It's always a famous thing. But I have needs, you know, that Dharma, Artha, Kama, and Moksha, these needs, still the only way to deal with them is in connection with the Lord. There isn't another way. It's illusion to think anyone is successful by some other process. Right? We're seeing the difference. Not that the difference is there. So it's either by pleasing the Lord directly through devotional service, and the Lord being satisfied knowing that these are your needs and desires, he fulfills them. Or if you're not so pious, then you don't see the Lord involved in it, but you're willing to follow God's laws, so you perform what in this world they call pious. Just the rules and regulations of the scriptures. And from that they get the results. So there's not another method. Or if you are unable to appreciate Dharma and the actual nature of something, and your only point is how to gain my result in the most direct, efficient mechanical method. And that's called artha or niti. And so I don't worry so much about Dharma. I just see what is the functioning of the direct laws right now that just deal with just what I want. I'm not worried about bigger results, bigger reactions. Like, I want that. I don't have money. So I'm very clever to follow the laws of stealing so I actually get it. But I don't see the bigger picture that stealing will have other reactions later. That's called niti. You know, what will work right now? No other considerations. Right? Sound like our modern society? Okay. So that's what it's working on. And so, but still, you don't follow the rules. It doesn't work. Right? So then the person is frustrated. He's trying because he's not God conscious. He does not understand the scriptures. And he's not clever enough to actually see the mechanics that's going on around him. Right? Definite patterns are there. Right? And he's not able to see. So then they take shelter of either their own speculation and get very frustrated, right? End up committing suicide or something. Or they take shelter of other people who are more intelligent and who have an understanding to some degree of the niti of how the material energy works. And then they think, here's something practical. Because the person that deals with practical does not understand practical means what for my narrow keyhole vision works right now. That's it. That's the actual definition that the modern man uses to when he says practical. That's all. Nothing more glorious than that. But why does it work? Because he's so intelligent and he's so practical. No, because that's God's system. That's all. So when we try and use our intelligence to prove that there's something else other than God, know that endeavor to be atheism. That's all. Because there are degrees of theism. Right? And all or nothing, you know, philosophy, then, you know, you either, you know, nasty, stinky, carmy demon, or you're a devotee. Right? So, yes, but within devotional service, or within your, you know, nasty, stinky atheism, there is gradation. So some people have faith that there is a supreme. But of course, because I'm an illusion, I don't see him working here. Therefore, I'm the controller of what I see. So ultimately, there's a supreme. Right? And this goes on daily in people who will call themselves theistic. Because otherwise, how can we say, I will do whatever I want despite the laws of God? I chant Hare Krishna, I don't need to follow the rules. Who made the rules? Alfred E. Newman? You know? Who made them? God made them. So to not see that is illusion. That's Maya. That's called less intelligent. Right? So, but unfortunately, when a lot of these unintelligent people get together, they think themselves very intelligent. Right? And then they certify their lack of intelligence. And we generally call these, you know, modern academic institutions that are committed to atheistic study. And even those who are theistic, do they actually believe that the creation that's here is God's and it's working because this is how God made it? It's his laws that make it function. Or do they say, well, there's religion, there's science, and we're synthesizing science and religion. How do you synthesize? What does that mean? It's already synthesized. God made it. So what is the synthesis? The synthesis is simply your understanding that it already is. Right? God is. It's not when we become aware, then God exists. This is Buddhism. Right? I'm aware then when the tree falls over in the forest and makes sound. If I'm not there, it doesn't make sound. Why? Because I'm the supreme controller. Isn't that the disease? That's the disease of the living entity. So, therefore, that process that shows this connection, that is the highest. Lack of appreciation of that, lack of seeing of that, is lack of intelligence. So this means that, as Narad Muni is pointing out how to connect this yoga system, which is a system of self-realization, to God, it's useless. Or his material needs to God, then it's useless. And what else is there? Your material needs, which is dharma, artha, kama, and moksha. Or your spiritual needs, right? That of serving Krishna. Note that moksha, or what we call a spiritual position, or transcendental, is still counted within the material needs. Because it's a material as long as it doesn't include God as a person. So, for all actual spiritual needs, or all material needs, there is only turning to God. That's what Narad Muni is doing here. He's giving in the spiritual process how to fulfill his material needs. He's dealing with both. It's complete. So to say that no, but to complete myself, I have to go outside of the purview of God consciousness means abject foolishness. One may have so many excuses. These excuses have been going on since time immemorial. It doesn't make them any more glorious or any more right or any more special. So we have to understand is that why is this special here, right? Somebody's sitting down and doing yoga and all, there's tons of them, you know, at this time, and there's, you know, millions of people doing that. Why this incident is chosen? Because this incident is actually being connected to the Lord through devotional service. So that incident is here. That's what makes Narad Muni special. He can see this. Always remember this simple logic. Is the person who understands the tree on the bank of the river, the real tree, knows the tree, understands how to interact with that tree, fully understands anything there is to know about the illusion of the reflection of the tree in the water. If this one very simple fact was understood, people would solve a lot of their, you know, inherent atheistic tendencies. Because to say that, no, someone who's in the water and values the illusion in the water, they know the tree in the water better, not the person who knows the real tree. I don't know if all this is too subtle. But in other words, those people who think Prabhupada and the previous acharyas don't know what they're talking about in 2010, they're atheists. That's all. That mentality is atheistic. They themselves may not be, but that mentality is 100% atheistic. Because it's total illusion to think there's anything other than Krishna. And that the people who know Krishna don't know what's going on in the material energy. That's like saying he's a mechanic for a Ferrari, but he wouldn't be able to figure out the Lego little car that his kid plays with. That's how intelligent that statement is. And I don't care how many letters you have after your name. You're still number one fool if you think like this. This is what Prabhupada meant. We kick on your face. So you preach atheism, we kick you in the face. We don't care who you are. Etiquette is there. So if we deal with you face to face, of course we're going to be nice. That's etiquette. But we're not. I'm sitting on this seat. I can say whatever I like. So this is the point. We kick on your face. Anyone who thinks that Prabhupada, the Acharyas, the Bhagavatam, this doesn't know absolute everything. And this is not fanatic. This is just fact. This is just facts. Why is it our attachment to illusion? That's liberal. That's broad-minded. No, that's as narrow-minded as you get. Just as an intellectual narrow-mindedness instead of a, you know, unintellectual narrow-mindedness. Otherwise, why is it called Mayaya Aprityajnana? Right? And what's the point? Impious people. What does impious mean? Not connected to God. That's all. Pious means connected to God. Impious means not connected to God. It's that simple. So we have to understand is that there is no excuse. One can doubt, one can ask questions, but generally we're not dealing with doubt, we're dealing with misgivings. Doubt means intelligence, misgiving means mind, emotions. So the intelligent, so-called intelligent man covers his ignorance with so-called intellectual statements. But his attachments to the material energy are just as solid as the person who doesn't intellectually deal with his That's all. That's all. It's just like the difference. Some guy is happy in a back alley to, you know, be intimate with his girlfriend. Someone else would never consider that, you know, anything lower than, you know, the 50th floor on the Upper East Side. He wouldn't even dream of it. You know, if it's not a penthouse, you know, it's not worth getting intimate. But what's the difference? It's just a particular material taste. That's all. It's just an intellectual material taste. That's why we have the term jnani. Jnani means someone who has knowledge that they don't see in connection with God. That's all. Otherwise, we call it jnana yoga. Right? We say a jnana yogi. But when we say a jnani, that means they have knowledge. They use their powers of speculation to come up with something other than God. That's all. And they're attached to their senses. Though they'll claim it's all nice and intellectual, but bottom line, it comes down to their senses. Their position, their sense gratification, their social status. What else are they arguing over? What else is being argued over? Anything else other than Dharma, Artha, and Kama, and Moksha? Anything else? No. So it's that mundane. But we don't like that. Why? The false ego never likes being said we're an idiot. Right? We never like being the fool. No? We don't like. So that's why then we'll fight. And then they're more intelligent. So then, I mean, intelligent meaning in the way of material intelligence. And so they're able to, you know, come up, argue, fight, this, that, blah. And the common person doesn't have that. They'd rather just, you know, do some work, pay the bills, and, you know, try not to have your family implode on you, you know. So, you know, let the intellectuals sit around and fight over this stuff, you know. It's pretty amazing. You actually get paid to do that, right? Like that. Of course, they do have to fight for it, right? You know, it's like the behind the scenes. One thing that just came up in discussion yesterday is that this academic world that these academics function in, they generally consider it's a very big world, right? Because there's universities all over the world. Thousands, I mean, just in Boston, you have 10 universities and 500,000 students. But if you think about it, the persons on campus, the undergraduates, all they know is they're there to study these things, get their degree, and go away. They never actually, they are in on campus, but they're in their own social scene. They're not part of the academic social scene. They're part of their own college idiot scene. Only when you're a postgraduate, then you become part of the academic social scene. And how many of them are there in comparison? Very small. Right? So it's a very small world. You know, I think Disney had it right, no? So, very small world. And somehow or another, we get distracted and think it's so important. When basically, except in their own circles, they don't have any influence. Nobody cares. Nobody knows, unless you read some science journal or some other academic journal. You'll never even know these people exist. And who cares? And then we want to impress them, who are unimpressible. You know, maybe with a steamroller you could impress, but other than that, you know. So, basically here is then Prabhupada's is pointing out here this practical point, this Astanga Yoga system then is being described in Shankhya Yoga. So Shankhya Yoga means the analytical study of the material energy. Actually what it is. Right? Based on actual facts and figures. By doing that it breaks down one's interest in the material energy, or it breaks down the illusion about how the material energy works. In other words, through Shankhya you can understand the only way things are functioning is because of God's involvement. Right? It means, of course, you can study the atheistic Kapila and not come to that conclusion. But The point of it is to understand God's in control. Everything that you're dealing with functions because of that. So Shankya gives exact definitions of everything. There's nothing more scientific than Shankya. Right? Because it analyzes to such a degree. So that part of the Ashtanga Yoga system, or, you know, which is the essential working point, is how to break down one's attachment to the material energy and transfer it to the Supreme Lord. Instead of meditating on the senses and sense objects, one meditates on the Lord. So the Shankya system then affords that you can deal with your field of activity and engage the senses as long as you understand the breakdown and the mechanics of it. That's understood, you won't be entangled. The easiest is not get involved, but if you want to get involved, then you can, because you see the mechanics of how God's involved in it. So it's a very, very powerful direct system. That's why we see the Kapila Muni's instructions are there. So we see now this point is being based on that. You know, the previous, what was in the previous canto. The activities of the previous canto, which are defining Shankya, are based on what's in the second canto, which is defining the mechanics of the universe. Right? So in all these ways, then the actual application and devotional service on you want material desire, but do you know what you're wanting? What it is that you're getting? What is important? Right? So that's what you have to look for. Otherwise, how do you know you even get what you want? Right? Somebody has a bottle of perfume. Why do they have it? Right? The bottle looks nice. Okay, so aesthetics. They like all nice little shaped bottles on their shelf. Okay, so then what does that mean? When you go out to buy a bottle of perfume, what are you looking for? The best looking bottle. A unique bottle. You don't have to worry about the fragrance. It's just the bottle has to be good. Right? Now, what if you go out and they say, oh, this is the best perfume, and you go out and buy it, and then you get home and open the box, and the bottle is not very nice. Great smell, but not a nice bottle. Are you going to be satisfied? No. Okay. Let us say the reason that you have this bottle of perfume is for the fragrance itself. So that means when you buy perfume, you don't worry about the bottle and you don't worry about the label. You worry about what smells good. Because if you worry about these other two, you may not get what smells good. Right? So if that's your point, it smells nice, you know, so whatever smells nice, go out and buy yourself some Kus oil. It smells nice. People will go, wow, what's that? You know, but let's say you have this bottle of perfume and it's for prestige, the social thing. Then you better be buying some brand name that is in the market now that you see in all the magazines and all the celebrities are using. Even if it doesn't smell good, people will smell it and go, oh, that's this one. Wow. So you have to know, even you're being a materialist, you have to analyze what are you looking for? Otherwise, how do you know you're going to get it? So that's the point, is that whatever you're looking at, now you connect it to Krishna. What is the good smell? What is the social position, prestige? What is the aesthetics? That itself is Krishna. That's what you're attracted to. So all these things can be connected. It's, of course, on a lower level. No one's saying that Dhruva Maharaj performing his Ashtanga Yoga to get a kingdom bigger than his father's was not downright materialistic. Completely materialistic. But because he's turned to the Supreme Lord, now it becomes Karma Yoga. And his going after this then elevates him to the platform of Krishna consciousness. But his inspiration in the beginning is not Krishna consciousness. He's just going to God because he's the one that can fulfill your desire. So he's completely motivated. But that determination, he follows the process that's given. And by following this process, he is successful. And in being successful, because he's following the process in connection with the Lord, then he realizes the Lord and sees, yes, God's in everything, but between God as a person and interacting with him as a person and God as, you know, the biggest kingdom in the universe, there's no comparison. It only takes a spark of Krishna's potency to maintain the whole cosmic creation, let alone just, you know, one part meaning that you're king of the universe. Right? Indra is the king of the universe. But he's not the biggest person in the universe. Brihaspati is bigger than him. The Prajapatis are bigger than him. The people on, you know, the Tapasvis and all those, and those who meditate on the Janatapa and Satyaloka are bigger. The yogis are bigger. Brahma is bigger. Yeah? So that means above his place, everybody up there is greater. And none of them want to be king of the universe. Like, you know, their point is, you know, let Indra do that. You know? So it's like, you know, it's like, you know, fighting over the prestige to be in charge of the broom closet or something, you know, it's like that, you know. So this prestige is lower. Anything material is lower in comparison. So the devotee, though both of them go on simultaneously, if they're sincere, then they will see the comparison between the actual devotional and the best that you can get on the material platform. They don't compare at all. I mean, if liberation is like a drop compared to the ocean, unlimited ocean of devotional service, and liberation is compared to an ocean compared to a drop of material happiness, right? And here we're taking the drop to mean Lord Brahma, right? And I think we went through it before, like it was a billion times down from that. A billionth of what Brahma experiences is the emperor of the world here, right? So we can understand it's not going to be hard to compare them. But why do we have a difficulty with this? It's either got to be all sadhana or, you know, all realism. Why? Because we actually have faith that the material energy has something serious to offer. Right? Does that make sense? Someone is philosophical nonsense. Nobody cares. Like the point we were discussing earlier in the class. Very few people care. But if somebody does something within this world that would be seen of engaging the senses, getting some prestige, wealth, power, influence, right? You know, below liberation, dharma, artha, and kama. Whoa, that's very serious. This is nonsense, you know, lifetime or eternal damnation or, you know, something. Why? Why would that be? Something that's philosophically wrong, which is so much more significant. You know, it can destroy your devotional endeavor for millions of lifetimes. Right? But that's no big deal. Nittai went to Prabhupada and said, I'd like your blessing, you know, to find, you know, a bona fide spiritual master. Because he was playing around, because he was, you know, one of these intellectuals, you know, you'd probably find him on Vast there somewhere. And so then, he's playing around, you know, Vrindavan Babaji, this, that, so many other things. So Prabhupada says, I give you the blessing, you won't come in contact with a bona fide spiritual master for 1 million lifetimes. That's the significance of this. But devotees, you know, left, went off, you know, were breaking the four regular principles and just being nonsense and trying their best to enjoy material. Prabhupada didn't take it very seriously. Why? Because you're just playing with illusion. Right? It was like the kid playing with that reflection in the water, you know. How serious is that? He takes a stick, whacks it, this, that. Oh, he's breaking the tree, this, that. And it's like anyone on the bank will just go, stupid kid. Right, but now if he takes an axe and hits the real tree, now we're talking now some serious nonsense. So when you attack the spiritual master, the instructions, the Vedas themselves, that's real nonsense. This other is only has significance as long as it means something to us. Right? Why is corporal punishment there for a Shudra, but not for a Brahmin? Because it doesn't mean anything to a Brahmin, and it means so much to a Shudra. Right? The Brahmin knows he's not the body, but because of his attachment to material energy, he's done something stupid. So, therefore, you're going to correct it on that intellectual platform by proper sadhana, proper association, because that's what's value to them. The body's not so much about, but the Shudra, they value the body so much, they think they're the body. Therefore, if you don't punish the body, they'll say nothing happened. Just in the same way as someone's philosophically wrong, oh, that's no big deal. But if they do something wrong with the senses and prestige and money and justice, then that's something serious. Do we understand what we're talking here? So, point is that the engagement of our whatever we're interested in Krishna's service, fulfilling the material side, that's the small thing for Krishna, though for us it may be the big thing. For Krishna, what's big is offering devotional service. So in the case of Dhruva Maharaj, it's not that Dhruva got a kingdom that was greater than his father's that's the big deal to Krishna. The big deal to Krishna is Krishna gave himself. That's the big deal. Right? So these two can go side by side, but if you don't understand that it's the yoga that is the important, not the karma, then that lack of sincerity will create problem for you and others. But if it's done properly, it's not going to. Or it's going to create minimal. I mean, okay, Dhruva Maharaj did make the whole universe suffocate, so, you know, that is a problem. Right? So then they had to come and correct that. But, so there's always going to be some problem. When you deal with the material world means problem. Like, it's just reading in the purport, where Prabhupada's pointing out, is Prabhupada's point? Yeah. Pointing out the material energy, because of its nature, it's even hard to create with it. There's even obstacles in creation, just because of its nature. Right? Material energy means obstacles, means problems. So, it's even a problem to work with to create. Like that. So there's so many things come up. You know, you're doing creation, all the poison comes out. All these different things happen. It's just like, you know, it's crazy. You know, Brahma's creating and then these demons attack him to eat him, right? You know, it's like, you know, life's not easy, you know. We're thinking.
Thank you very much, Maharaj. Please feel free to smash this if you think it's complete nonsense, but...
Okay. Why not? On your order.
I couldn't help but think, when you're minimizing the academic world,
yes,
on its size or, you know, the numbers of people involved, even though they may be nameless or famous among themselves only, they are teaching a lot of people, and somehow or other this atheistic philosophy is spreading quite...
Yes, No, the atheistic philosophy is already there. It's not that they're creating it, it's already there. Bhaktivinoda Thakur describes, you know, like 15, 20 or more different varieties of material consciousness that generates different varieties of philosophies and religions. So what they're talking is nothing new. Right? It means they can't even get it together to talk up to, you know, like what Aristotle, Plato and all that, which they'll base their whole thing on. You know? So they can't even discuss on that level. So, you know, it's not that there's anything that they're coming up with that's new. they've always been there. It's just a matter of whether you want to be aware of them or not. I'm making this point in relationship to saying that two things. One would be, when devotees are talking about being practical and this and that, that academic world doesn't really affect them. It doesn't have any influence. It means the academic world has effect on the, how you say, the contemporary culture only when some clever either businessman or influential person, you know, person with power, takes what they're talking about and applies it. But the academic themselves don't have really that much potency. In their own world they do. They're afraid of each other. But outside it's kind of like, who cares? Yeah, take you know, Hawkins, you know, in his wheelchair, take him down in the middle of, you know, some slumware somewhere, and let him, you know, down to the base basketball court, and let him start talking. Do you think those kids will even care? Yeah, you know, I mean, so they couldn't care less. Who cares? You know, anyone else cares? Okay, he says there's no God because of this. Who cares? Right? So the point is that the academic world on its own, it, yes, influences a lot of people in like this in one way, but at the same time, they themselves as individuals aren't that potent. That's my point. So to give them more position means you must be connected with that world or somehow or another in contact or have faith in that world that you would think that they have a position when they don't really. Then if you look at it from the other side of them, you know, that they're the ones teaching all the youth of today, and so they have the influence. But the point is what's actually the basis of their involvement? Their personal commitment or their academic ability? So when they go into the classroom, they have to speak according to their academic ability. And they have to speak whatever is accepted, whether they like it or not. They may throw out their opinion now and again, but you still have to pass the test according to what's accepted. That's all. So, therefore, trying to please them by making an adjustment in our books or preaching techniques won't matter anyway, because they can't adjust their atheistic position anyway. Right? It's an atheistic, academy. And if they, unless they profess their lack of non-conclusive, you know, so-called objective point of view, they won't be in the position they're in. In other words, it is a job ultimately, right? So their social position, their money, everything goes by them simply speaking what those who are in the senior position say they should. That's all. Even we're saying, are we influencing the ones that are in the classroom, or are we influencing the ones that actually create the basis for what's spoken in the classroom? You know what I'm saying? There's one Leakey, and then all the other anthropologists all over the world, that, you know, tens of hundreds of thousands of, have to speak what he's saying. So if we're really being, will this influence him? Is that the vision? I don't think so. I don't think it's that big. I think we're dealing with a very meager vision here. And then the other way is the academy goes on in the way that it does because the people that are in it actually have faith in it. But that faith is that faith is because of their academic skill, or is because of their own personal commitment. You understand? That they agree to be a teacher in this system, and there's some value to it. Would that be because that's just what they were taught, or they personally may believe that? Right? So now, as a person, you can influence an academic that he himself will take up Krishna consciousness. But in the classroom, there's very minimal he can influence, because he's one person. So if you really want to change the academy, you have to influence the academics as individuals. Right? That means you have to cut beyond that illusory, you know, veneer of intellectualism down to what actually is the value in their personal life. So you make them devotees, then there's enough of them, then they'll change what is presented. right? Because before, the those that had faith in God, they were the teachers, and they taught, you know, in relation to God consciousness. Then with time, there was such a separation between what those who were God conscious would accept, you know, culturally and scientifically, and those who were more intellectual, that they became two different, so-called different paths. So this is the disease that even devotees today are burdened with, that there's a difference between science and religion. Right? Science is simply the theory on which the mechanics of religion work. Religion means the nature of something. Right? If we say a dog barks because that's his nature, you know, we'll say that's not science. You know, that's some social, or maybe, okay, but why biologically he has to bark? No, that's just the way he was made. Right? You know, otherwise he's not a dog. If he meows, we'll say he's a cat, you know. So, you're going to have these elements. So, in here is that they may be important, but what do you want? You're going to try to come up against the face of the academy? Or you're going to go to the root, which is the people who have faith in the academy? Right? And if they're intelligent, they need logical explanations. And by changing what Prabhupada says, that doesn't make it logical. That's just adjusting the sentiment. And then the point is then they'll say this is the intellectual presentation. You know what I'm saying? So I would go so far as to say that those who recommend adjusting Prabhupada's books can't even explain the difference between the intelligence and the mind. They're that unscientific, though they're claiming to be. They use fancy words, but you'll generally find is it's a lot of sentiment and very strongly presented. Main thing is they're insecure because they themselves don't have faith in what Prabhupada said. Otherwise, if you had faith in Prabhupada said, why would you want to change it? No, you can change the presentation, but why would you change the book? Right? Out of the billions of books that are out there, how many are actually read by these academics that they're worried about? You know what I'm saying? So, the point, you can say, well, these people aren't joining. That's because we don't have the faith to be an intellectual ability to teach them. Because when we do go to the academy and you get your degrees, they actually become a member of the academy. They're nothing less. They actually think like that. I'm speaking from personal experience of dealing with our top people in the field. Our top ISKCON, you know, who would be considered the top. You know, and I'm talking dead or alive here. And it's affected every last one of them without exception. And then with that, they're going to change it? You're not going to change it. Right? There's more influence in the world of what people think about science by people who are willing to butt heads with it. You know? Like that. They go right out there and show in their own terms how they're wrong. They don't like it. But the academic self may not take it. But all the people in that academic class that you're worried about that they have influence over start listening to us. You understand? So, therefore, that was Prabhupada's method. Kick on their face. Because if it's They claim to be intellectuals. If they're real intellectuals, if it's logically presented, they'll go, okay. Right? So, but the point is you have to take what's there. You know, Prabhupada, take whatever it is, the points they want to change. Those are the theory. That's the thesis. But they don't notice the process by which Prabhupada explains it. They're not intelligent enough to understand logic. Because otherwise a thesis is made, then the support of it is there, you know, or expansion, then all the arguments that break down what anybody else may say about it, then synthesized, and then its practical application. I guarantee you there's not one person in the modern, you know, of our own devotees in that academy that understands this logic that Prabhupada uses. They don't. So that's my point, is they're not real academics. Real academic means they know the Vedic philosophy. Real academic means they know, you know, the Vedanta. But, you know, more than very expert in using modern words in modern ways, I don't think they really are that good. Some of them, I mean, I'm not saying they're not clever and they don't have a high IQ. What I'm saying is that it's misused, that it's not in connection with Krishna. And so they're doing a great disservice to this movement. Prabhupada wrote these books for 10,000 years. After 10,000 years, come back, change the books. We don't mind, because the movement's not supposed to go on anyway. So after 10,000 years, change the books. Let the whole thing go to hell. You know, hey, it just makes it more fun for Kalki when he comes, right? You know, like that. But for the next 10,000, what's the meaning? Prabhupada said you can write purports to his purports, but I don't hear them talking that. No, they want to change. Why? Because it threatens their own material existence. That's all. Nothing less. Not, I mean, they're trying to present it as preaching and, oh, but we're worried about, no, because they themselves can't explain what is intelligence, what is intellectual understanding. They can't even see that their motive is simply based on the mind and their own subjective feelings. And what they're worried about is the subjective feelings of the academics. So why are the academic subjective feelings something more important than someone else's? Thousands of people have become devotees, tens of thousands. And they didn't have any problem with these things. But those who these have problems, these are misgivings. They're not doubts. Doubts you can clear. But you explain this to them, it doesn't clear. It means you have one academic saying all these things, everybody else is in the room. You can explain it. He won't understand, everyone in the room will. I've seen it myself. I had a PhD sitting in the room. I made a point. Everyone in the room understood. They didn't. They asked their question. We dealt with it. Then everybody else understood more. They didn't. And because they're the PhD, they think they're the most intelligent, so if they don't understand it, it wasn't correctly presented. What to do? This is what we're talking about as foolishness. Okay. What's your... Is it on this point or something else? It's on this point or something else? Because if it's something else, then we'll stop here. Yes, but it's at the end. It's different from what I'm talking about there. It has to go into the question. Is it directly on this, or then what is it?
I just wanted to share one kind of joking comment on how academics think of themselves. They think okay. They're so important. And it goes, never before has so much been said about so little to so many people, but heard by so few.
So yes, that's good, yeah. Because now it's they get down to, before we used to joke in the 60s about someone doing a PhD on a tsetse fly. But now they'll only do it on a certain portion or aspect of the tsetse fly. You know, like that. You know. Yes, that's good. Okay, so we'll end here, and then anyone has more questions, we'll continue after 5 minutes. So, Grantaraj Srimad Bhagavatam Ki, Srila Prabhupada Ki, Samaveta Bhaktivrinda Ki, Jainatai Gaura Premanandi. Some questions. Okay, otherwise we have here Viresh from Bombay. How important is Bhaktivedanta Institute? Srila Prabhupada himself said that it is important, but how does one understand Bhaktivedanta Institute? We'll be preaching mission. Bhaktivedanta Institute means that you, the knowledge and methods, the language that the academics use, specifically here the Institute was for, specifically for the scientists. But it can be anyone in any aspect of the academic field, was how to present our philosophy in their language, but never changing our philosophy, never making a compromise and adjusting. It's a matter of using terms that they can appreciate. You know, if you say Krishna, they may not appreciate, but if you say supreme or like this, then there's more of a adjustment. So what we see is that those who are willing to be more bold get more recognition by the general mass of people, maybe less in the academic world, but there, that people see that there's an alternative presentation. Or you have those who are less, and they may socially deal nicer, but the point is you're supposed to convince them as individuals, right? There's only a limited amount that you can do as an academic, but there's so much you can do in making them a devotee, right? So one doesn't have to be an academic to preach to academics. I mean, one example I knew back in the, I think it was 80s, late, yeah, 70s, 80s, there was one devotee, I think at the time he was the temple president of Los Angeles. And he hadn't finished high school. He didn't have a high school degree that I know of. And but I think it was twice a week he would lecture down at UCLA at the university to, I mean, a big, not one of these little rooms with five people, 300 students, one of those big lecture halls on something to do with philosophy or religion, all that. You know, the professor's there, but he would be the one who would come and speak. So he was respected for what he knew because he was a monk, right? But the academics are so proud that they think, let's say you have someone who's there, they've done a PhD on Tibetan Buddhism, and you had the Dalai Lama. And the academic's mind is they know more than the Dalai Lama on Tibetan Buddhism. This is how, you know, unintelligent they are. So they think simply by analyzing for a couple of years and writing a, you know, 300, 500 page paper, that they become the world expert. There's things that they will never know even exist in Buddhism. You know, because only what they can get, because they only ask certain questions. Like that. You know, they don't think in the ways. So they will say that they're the expert. That's the problem with the academy. So the Bhaktivedanta Institute is meant to somehow or another convince them, either as a scientist or as an individual. So if they're doing that, then it's successful. If they're not doing that, then they should relook at what they're doing. Okay, I think Mataji has a question. No, it doesn't. Oh, okay.
No,
they're not as main. The rules are supportive, but it doesn't mean they're not done. Just like, what's more important, the job or the money you get from the job? Which is more important? Right? The money. But does that mean the job's not done? No, the job is the medium through which you'll get the money. So Krishna consciousness and chanting is the most important. And as long as all we need to do is chant, then that's perfect. But if we find that we also, you know, have need of family life, the interactions of family life, the facilities of family life, and so therefore we have to be, you know, economically developed and, you know, socially active and all these different things to establish a comfortable position to live in, and then in that position, then we can be Krishna conscious. Then the process of following the rules and regulations that connect all those distractions to Krishna are very important. You know? So it's true that, let's say, a brahmachari who's in the temple and is fully engaged there's very few rules he needs to follow, because he's dealing with very minimal amount of the material energy. But for a grihastha to say that, no, they're the ones that have to follow the most rules. Rules are meant for grihasthas. That's what they're written for. Right? If this was like a planet where it was just all brahmacharis living in the forest, would we have to have laws on land and inheritance and children and marriages how you deal with various relations, you know, the different kinds of purity connected out, you know, the things that are in grihastha life that are not in the brahmachari life. You know what I'm saying? Do we need a big organization? Do we need power? Do we need armies? Do we need all that? No, those are all there because there's grihasthas. So that's the point, is that if a brahmachari says we chant Hare Krishna, we don't care the rules, I'm not complaining. He just has to make sure that he doesn't actually not do things that he should do in sadhana. But when grihasthas say that, it's kind of absurd.
Me also. Because so many times we are going very fast. Oh, I must make this, I must make my service, I must make this, another. If one devotee can need you, I do not have time for this devotee. Entonces, your heart becomes
but
like
you have others. To find a balance. It's all about balance. Just like, if you're cooking a sabji, does it need salt? Right. And without salt, there's no flavor. Right? So, in one sense, you could say salt would be one of the more important elements of a sabji. But, if I put more salt, does it work? No. You have to put right amount. So the point is that service is important, all these are important, but if your relations with devotees is also not proper, then it's also, you've missed the point, because we're following these things, what, to go back to Godhead, and when you get back to Godhead, there'll be plenty of devotees. So the idea of associating devotees here and there, then it has to be done correctly. Like that. So you have to find how to make it work. Otherwise, then be less involved. And that's the point. Brahmachari is less involved. So there's less to balance. Grihastha is more engaged. There's more to, so if the grihasthas complain, oh, life's so difficult, you guys have it easy, you don't know what it means, that's your choice. You know, why you're complaining. You know, you can't complain about something that's inevitable. You can't do anything about it, right? You know, we're walking out in the field, it starts raining. There's no use complaining about it. We can't do anything about it. Right? If you were smart, you would have brought an umbrella. But we didn't. Okay. So we get rained on. So complaining will not change. So the whole point is that we're in this situation, and if we're involved in these things, complaining about it won't make it any better. Complaining won't make it look like you're intellectual. Complaining won't make it look like you're detached. Because the point is if you're detached, then it's not for you, and the problem's not yours, it's Krishna's. So therefore, you want to solve Krishna's problem. Yes.
You might have already talked about this, but since that I need to some more clarification, you were mentioning how modern men, practical men, they are successful because not because of their intelligence, but because they are pleasing God. So, how is that? Persons who do not accept God.
How do people who don't accept God, how are they successful in the world? Right. The point is it's success means what? If we take it by mechanics, success means what? Okay, achievement of one's desires, okay? So, that means that, one is that there is such a thing as desire, who created that? Yes. Okay, and that you can get a result from work, who created that? Okay. Now, let us say you have a particular field of activity, okay? Now, can you just do anything in that field to get any result? No? Let us say you're in the kitchen, okay? Can I win the Grand Prix in the kitchen? Grand Prix. Can I win a car race or, let's say, a horse race in the kitchen. No, you have to be in the field of activity for a race. But let's say I am out on the Indianapolis 500 track and I have a fancy car and I'm in this seat. Will I win a cooking contest? No. So you have to be in the field. Who has decided that? God. Okay, now in the field, that if you connect, you somehow or another expose things in the kitchen to heat in an appropriate way, then it gets cooked. Who has established that? God. Okay. And then, let's say, certain spicings have different effects on this cooking process and on the result of this cooking process. Who's established that? Right? Salt is salty. It's not sweet. It's not bitter. But, you know, God, these different things. Okay. So now, if you want a result, let's say I want a finished preparation of potatoes that are salty and, let's say, rich. What do I have to do? Yes, and potatoes, put them in a pot, boil them till they're soft, and put the appropriate amount of salt and butter and pepper and all that. Right? So have I established that? No. So I'm smart enough to be able to tell the difference between too much salt and not enough salt, but I haven't established what is too much salt and not enough salt. You understand? No, we haven't established that. God's established that. Right? Does that make sense? You take a potato, you cut it up, put it in a pot with water, put it on a fire, and it boils for 20 minutes, it will be cooked. Right? It means here. If I go to New York, do the same thing, it also will be cooked. I go to Los Angeles, I do the same thing, it will be cooked. I go to Tokyo, and I do the same thing, it will be cooked. Okay? Now, of course, someone could say, no, but if you're on top of Everest, then it will take either a shorter time or longer time. But that also is established by God. So the point is the cooking process is God's laws of how His material energy interacts on this level of cooking. So all they've been is intelligent enough to observe the already existing laws. They don't create the laws. So that's what I'm saying. You can be a complete atheist and a complete materialist and still be successful boiling your potatoes. But you can only be successful if you follow God's laws. That's my point. So anybody in this world who's successful is only because they follow God's laws. Yes, Krishna says everyone follows the path. Now it's a matter of, in following the path, what's your level of consciousness? This is what is not understood. Is that because of the Mayavadi concept that when I change consciousness, it changes the activity performed. Right? It may change the quality of the activity, but it won't change the activity. Right? Let us say I'm on the lowest level of consciousness. On Anamoy, I'm cooking, boiling these potatoes for myself. Right? And I'm going to cut them to, you know, a certain, this 1-inch cubes, and I'm going to put them in a pot with the water, and I'm going to put, you know, I want to put, you know, 100 grams of butter, and, you know, half a teaspoon of salt, okay, and a quarter teaspoon of pepper, okay? So, now, let us, and then I'm going to cook it. When I finish, it's for me, and that's it, okay? Now, let us say I raise the consciousness to pranamoy. And now you're going to the kitchen and you're going to cook those potatoes for your friend. Right? For their benefit. They're hungry, and so you say, hey, I can boil you some potatoes. Will the recipe change? No. Okay. Now let's say we go to a higher level, manamoy, and you have some family members, and because they see that their position in the family, and so taking care of the family, not because of just sentimental attachment, because of their duty as a grihastha, and all that based on the Shastra, and they're going to cook potatoes for their family. Does the recipe change? No. Okay, now let's say we raise it again to Vijnanamoy. And on the place of Vijnanamoy, then, you know, where liberation is the, you know, the goal and where understanding the nature of the soul is. So now they want to, they're going to perform an activity, you know, since they have to eat, of boiling these potatoes. But it won't be for any specific, you know, material, specific result for their own personal thing. It will be based on the platform of Naishkarmya. Right? In other words, you're taking this process of, it's completely for you, it's for the other person, but you're involved because they're benefit. I'm doing it because it's my duty, or I'm doing it because it will free me from material existence. So the element of Naishkarmya is getting more. But the recipe hasn't changed. Now let us say we raise it to the highest platform of Anandamaya, of devotional service. So now the devotee is going to cook some potatoes for Krishna. Does the recipe change? No. So the problem is devotees will think that the recipe changes. If I become a devotee, then the recipe changes. Right? Because the Mayavad philosophy is, you know, whatever you do in material life, the activities and feelings, all that, that's material. And it's true. So spiritual means doing none of that. That makes it spiritual. No, spiritual means doing the same activities connected to God. Right? And since now, and in the connection to God, we can still connect, you know, our Anamoy platform to God. So the activity doesn't change. And our consciousness may be lower, but then like Dhruva Maharaj, it's only about himself. He's not thinking, well, I'm a Kshatriya, so I have to have the kingdom and this and that. You know, and he's not thinking, well, I get this kingdom and then, you know, my mother won't be harassed by my stepmother. No, he's thinking, I'm getting this for myself. It's his own false ego that's been disturbed. So he's working basically on Anamoy. Right? But he's engaging that in the Lord's service. And in doing that, then he's elevated to the transcendental platform. Right? So understanding this, this is the weakness. This is what Gita talks about. So this is the ABCs of spiritual life. Right? This is not some big esoteric. This is just, this is basic stuff. Right? You know, esoteric is, you know, the gopi is looking at Krishna and then she turns her head like this. What does that mean? That's esoteric. That's fine stuff. This is just, you know, how you say, bare bones philosophy. Is that you, it says, right, that address that Prabhupada gives, the that kind of like that, I don't know what it's called, but that famous one, I think the Chintamani and after that, and then he reads from the purports of Brahma Samhita. And so in there he says that there's no need to change anything, you just have to change consciousness. You change the consciousness and whatever activity you're doing, whatever motive you have, if it's connected to Krishna, it becomes purified. Then with time, as you give up the motive that I'm cooking these for myself, then it's a matter of, you know, I'm cooking what I want for myself for Krishna. It's like, what would Krishna like? So the cooking process won't change, but your recipe might change. Only because it's in consideration of Krishna's pleasure. You know? But still, the science itself doesn't change. So the science that we find here in this material world is from the spiritual world. These things are there, right? Rain clouds come in the spiritual world, right? They make thunder and lightning. Rain comes out of them, right? It goes on in the spiritual world. That's reflected in the material world. So the science that's here is simply a reflection of the original. And then we'll claim it has nothing to do with God. So what I say is not their intelligence. It means if it's their intelligence, then it's simply intelligence alone should get their result. But no, intelligence has to be applied. And applied to what? God's laws. So someone whose intelligence understands that there are natural material laws and then following those laws, they get success. The problem is their success is very temporary because they're on the lowest levels of consciousness. So in dealing with these same things, if they dealt on a higher level of consciousness, then they would get that material benefit they're looking for and the spiritual. Right? And eventually they would see that why be endeavoring for the material? We should only be endeavoring for the spiritual. But still, the process doesn't change. Right? So the point, that's why there's a culture of Krishna consciousness. It's not jump. It's like this. What is the jump? You're standing there in front of your stove, pot's on the fire, water's in the pot, it's boiling, there's potatoes inside, you put salt already. So what has to jump? What is this, you know, lightning bolt has to come in through your window, but it won't come in the window. If it did come in the window, it only hit the tap. And then, you know, that'll make a mess in the kitchen. So if you want to get hit by that lightning bolt, you have to have a skylight in your kitchen. So everyone should make sure they have a skylight in the kitchen. Then the lightning bolt can come straight in through the skylight and hit you in the head. And then that epiphany, then you take the pot and turn it upside down, but the water mystically stays inside because of your spiritual potency. You understand? There is no jump. That's the thing is, that's the beauty of Krishna consciousness. Here you have a 5-year-old child who's so insulted. I mean, it's insulted to the point of insanity. Right? And he's so maturely motivated, it's also insane. You know, where is there a kingdom bigger than his father? His father is the king of the universe. There isn't bigger than that. But because he wants it, God arranges it by giving him the spiritual world to be king of. That's bigger. Right? All these other kings have come and gone. Dhruva's still there. Indra's come and go, 14 of them in the day of Brahma. Right? And so, you know, so it's, but for Dhruva, it's, so, he's a bigger king. So, all that had to be done was connect it to God. That's the only change. That's the basic. Then, in having connected it to God, then you can refine the quality of the connection. Does that make sense? You know, it's like, you know, you need some electricity in your house, and so you don't know what to do, so you go out and find, like, say, a coat hanger or something, and open it up, and kind of tie it up here, and kind of throw it over there, and stand back, you know, a few sparks and everything, but it works, it brings current, right? No, then you could go better than that, you could actually get some wire, but maybe it's not the right size, and you get the proper size, then it's, you know, aluminum, then you could get better, you could get copper, you could even have silver wire. You know, that would be considered even better. So, but the principle is you've made the connection. So when it's connected to God, no matter what it is, no matter how materialistic, it's connected. Now we're starting. Now reality starts. Before that, it was only illusion. But reality starting, then there's qualities of reality. Right? We'll take, no, it's all one. That's my body. No, it's there is variety. Right. So when it's connected to God and it's for ultimately for God's pleasure, though it's mixed with so many things, then it's not called pure devotional service. But it's still spiritual and it's still called devotional service. Right? So therefore we make a difference between devotional service, pure unalloyed devotional service. But devotional service also means all that. Right? You know, so whether it's a lower or it comes to prema or it comes to mahabhav, you know, so, but it's still devotional service. The activity doesn't change. The culture doesn't change. You know, some external manifestations may change. Does that make sense? So depending on what it's there. You want to make puree out of the tomatoes. You have a blender. You cold, you just put them in there and blend them up, and basically you'll get some tomato puree. You're a little bit more understanding of this, then you'll drop the tomatoes into boiling water. You know, when the skin splits, then you'll take them out, then put them in your blender. You'll get more juice out of them, like that. Let us say you don't have a blender. Okay, then again, you'll boil them and do that when they're, you know, a bit more soft. Then you pour all that through a strainer and then you'll, you know, like this, and then you'll get everything. More work, but hey, it worked. It did the job. Because you know what you're doing. So that's the point. So devotees are saying, oh, but we you know, we can't use a blender, and so, you know, we have to therefore not do it in connection to Krishna. No, that you're doing it for Krishna, that doesn't change. You know, the what you means, and that you're getting tomato puree doesn't change. But they're saying, oh, we don't have a blender, so we can't make tomato puree. But that means they're not very trained in the field. So to say, I can't cook because I don't have this first class kitchen. Someone who's a good cook, you can give them a bean can, and they could cook in it. You know? I mean, I've seen kids cook in a plastic bag. I'm not joking, a plastic bag. Right? Like that. It's a famous story in the school, but they cook in this plastic bag. So that means they don't really know what they're talking about, but they're pontificating that, oh, you can't do this, you can't do that, but they don't actually know what it is. They say, oh, you can't wear these clothes or those clothes. What level of clothes are they looking at? If it's just to cover your body, so, but why are you covering your body? What's the reason? Right? Clothes are there. Why is the reason you're wearing clothes? You know? So, based on that, then you have to see is that you say you can't wear devotional clothes, but why are you wearing devotional clothes? You know, what's the reasons? But because generally that can't be answered, so how can they give an alternative? Right? Does that make sense? You know nothing, you don't know why you're in the kitchen and you're saying that you can't cook. You know what I'm saying? But they don't know why they're there. You know, so that's the problem. So why can't you wear them? What's the reason? We're not saying that there aren't situations where you wouldn't wear devotional clothes. But what I'm saying is the reason many times devotees don't wear them are not necessarily very well thought out, not enough to make a philosophy. Right? So it actually comes out they're embarrassed. That's all. Because much of the time, whatever you wear anyway, most people aren't really going to notice. Right? And devotional clothes these days are not strange. You want to see strange, you go to a metals concert. You know, then you'll see strange. You know, it's like, we have a sikha, it's still the same color, right? It lays down. Some of them, kids have sikhas, but they're green and they stand up straight. That's more strange than what we do. Right? You know? So it's like all these different things. It's being different. Everybody's trying to be different anyway. But people don't know it. They don't know how to go about it. So they're unaware of why they're doing or not doing what in their life is said to be important. So that's what we're complaining about. We're not saying that there aren't situations, but Prabhupada, you know, very early days, devotees many times wore suits. Of course, they had shaved heads and tilak, but they wore suits, so that's not a problem. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur had his devotees wear, but they presented themselves directly as devotees. You know, but they changed the clothes and they changed the philosophy, changed the present, changed everything. No, Bhaktisiddhanta, he wouldn't change. If it's like, if by wearing karmic clothes, then they'll be, then do it, but then go speak straight. So, but they don't know why they're doing it. You know, why they even choose the clothes they do, or, It'll just be, I like it or I don't like it. So then basically you wear devotional clothes or not because you like or don't like. That's all. You know, there are people who can actually say why they wear what they wear. And those people, if they look at you, even if you are wearing karmic clothes, there's a good chance they would say that what you're wearing is not fashionable, is not correct, it's wrong. You know what I'm saying? So people who really care about fashion, they're not going to mind devotional clothes if they're worn nicely. They're going to care about how well it's worn, how tasteful it is. That's what they're looking at. They don't know these other clothes, so therefore they don't use them as a medium. But they're intrigued by chudders and beads, and they include them in their aesthetic presentations. But they don't know. They've grown up with pants and skirts and tops, and that's it. You know? But those people who don't have that kind of aesthetic sense, they're the ones who complain. And the ones who complain, unless you're wearing exactly what they wear in their particular group, they're going to think you look strange anyway. You know what I'm saying? So, it's basically, at some point you have to choose whose side you're on. Whose side you're on. Just like, let's say you have friends. You could be trying, and some other people then they don't like, and you know them. And so you can either say, yeah, these guys are out of it, and then put yourself in with them. And so it gets an immediate work done, but you lose a friendship. Or you say, the friendship's more important than this interaction with them. So I might lose some money, some position. The friendship is more worthwhile. You got to choose. You can't not choose. You know, we're people. We're dealing with people. You know, people, these modern philosophies try to make it where it's just for the good of all and all this, but it's just talk. What good of all? How is it good for all? You know what I'm saying? It's not. So, at some point you just got to choose, you know, who do you care more about? Does that make sense? You have the mic, so speak. On the very bottom.
I was thinking about time.
Time.
Like if I'm thinking, if we think in the material world, there is a certain speed.
Speed.
Yeah, and you know when we do our actions, and if I'm thinking about what's happening in the spiritual world, what are Radharani and Krishna doing right now? Is it there are things happening right now, and do they move in the same speed as us, or is it like more time is more?
But what does it matter?
No, I'm just thinking.
No, I'm saying, what does it matter? Why would it be a problem if they're moving faster or slower? You know what I'm saying? So it's not a problem. The point is that we're functioning within God's creation, right? So then, since we're within His creation, then whatever speed we're moving at, then what it means by time-wise, whatever time we're functioning at, then we relate to Krishna, then it doesn't matter because it's all part of Him. So all these different time frames are still all part of Him. So it doesn't matter what time frame they work at. Does that make sense? You know?
Maharaj, could you please explain about Krishna is not looking what we are giving, but what we are keeping for ourselves?
What we are giving, but what we are keeping for ourselves. Why are you worried about what you're keeping? You understand? means the focus is on what's being given, because that's where the devotion is expressed. It's what is being given. Now, if what you're not giving is getting in the way of your giving, then it's, you look at that. Does that make sense? You know, the person just comes in contact with Krishna consciousness, you know, just comes in and, you know, wants to do something, so they, you know, give a dollar or something. So now you're going to look at that. You gave just a dollar, you know, you have, you know, tens of thousands of dollars. What nonsense is this, you know, like that? Giving so small for God, God's a great, you know, is that the point? No, the point is they've given a dollar. Before they've given nothing, now they've given a dollar. So the point is, if you cultivate that, then that will become big. Right? Let's say you have a spark, right? And it's landed in a nice place for making a fire. So, now, if I worry about all the wood that's not burning, will that make the fire? Or do I worry about that spark and cultivating that spark in a place that it will burn? You understand? Once it's situated and there, then you can look at, well, what aspect of that piece of wood's not in the fire and all that, because the fire is established. Right? So that's why the Shraddha, Sadhu Sangha, you know, these two, that one is properly situated. And then in that environment, having the faith, being in the association of the devotees, then you take up the bhajana kriya, the devotional process. Right? Once you're situated there, then it's there's a distinction between, is one's bhajan, you know, how you say, progressive, or are there obstacles to that progression? Right? Then you look at it. So it's nishta bhajana kriya or anishta bhajana kriya. So if it's anishta, then there's anartha nivritti. Right? Does that make sense? So the problem is not getting rid of the anartha, the problem is remembering Krishna. But because remembering Krishna is what you want, then the anartha, which is making you forget Krishna, is getting in the way. So you want to remove the anartha that makes you forget, right? So that you can remember. Not that removing anarthas has a function on its own. It doesn't have a separate function. Does that make sense?
On the points of the levels of consciousness, at what level of consciousness can we achieve naishkarmya?
At what level of consciousness is naishkarmya? Basically, you can say from Manamoy, you can begin there. Because lower than that, it's self-centered. Because Anamoy and Pranamoy are both self-centered. One is just whether your pleasure is coming directly from yourself or your pleasure is coming from what that which is connected to you. Does that make sense? So, yeah. Does that make sense? So it's Manamoy is where it starts. So that's the lowest level of consciousness that's recommended. Right? That's considered an okay place to start from. I mean, if you can't be directly devotional, that's an okay place to start from. Because then, there you're performing the duties that you can apply naishkarmya on. Now, whether you're doing it in a naishkarmya mood or not, but at least the form is there. Right? You know, the person knows how to cook and is cooking, therefore it'll be very easy to introduce being Krishna conscious while cooking. But if the person doesn't know any cooking to teach them Krishna consciousness, you know, through not knowing how to cook will be difficult. Because they'll be so absorbed in trying to cook and this and that they won't remember either. You understand? So someone who's situated in properly, you know, in human society, it's very easy, because for a human being to be Krishna conscious is very easy. For an animal, it's not. Because when we say, like we were saying before, we're being practical. What are we being practical about? Our eating, our sleeping, our mating, and defending. That's what we're talking about. As far as becoming Krishna conscious, how is it practical? Right? Yeah, missing Krishna. So we're not saying you can't have a job and take care of your family and be Krishna conscious, but they're just saying, well, I'm being practical, because Krishna conscious simply means sadhana, in the temple chanting japa and going to Guru Puja. So I can't see that, yes, that's the most direct, but I can't see that how taking care of the family, that could be indirectly connected to Krishna. But we should never think indirect is better than direct. No, but indirect may be very practical. We have material desires, we need to deal with the indirect. Because material desire means indirect. In other words, if you see Krishna in it, we don't call it a material desire. Right? You have a material desire means you don't see Krishna in it. Therefore, it becomes indirect. So you have to connect Krishna to it. Though Krishna already is, it's that we have to connect it. Does that make sense?
So does that mean that Sakam also only starts on Manamoya?
Sakam also starts on Manamoya? No, Sakam you can drop it down lower. But Nishkam means you start seeing so-called glimmers of Nishkam in that, let's say, you know, you're sacrificing for family members or something like that. But it's only because they're your family. If they weren't your family, you wouldn't do it. So there is that element seemingly of nishkam, but it's still for yourself. Right? So it has that element, so you could start preaching it from there. But the point is unless God's involved, it doesn't actually have any meaning. Right? So if it's between, you know, better someone situated in Varnashram and performing Naishkarmi, or someone situated in below that in Artha and is, you know, practicing some form of Naishkarmi, you know, is it better to elevate them to Varnashram then start Naishkarmi, or start it from the Artha? The point is, when we're saying Naishkarmi, we mean doing it to please God. Right? So therefore, better it starts wherever it is. Right? Even if it's just they do things for themselves, but understand that still there's a supreme that's coming from. And so maybe, okay, you please God, and then immediately after that, yourself. Well, in Pranamoya, it would be God, then your family members, and yourself. Right? Does that make sense? So the most important is that it's just connected to God. So devotional Naishkarma you can apply from any level, but specifically being very technical about it, it becomes applied at Manamoya, because there is, you actually are doing it because that is a duty, that's the way it works, right? Your motive is nothing else other than this, the proper thing to do, right? And that's based on Shastra, on God's direction. So does that make sense? Right. So that would be your basis where you would start saying, this is what, you know, it's talking about. But because everything, Artha and Kama are expanding from Dharma, therefore they still will follow the same laws, though you don't have the same consciousness and same understanding. But mechanically they're the same. So it's, and I think we'll end here. Srila Prabhupada ki, Samaveta Bhaktivedanta ki, Chaitanya Gaura Premanandi.